ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
G'day, Dr. Carl here. Back in 1986, I could not wait to see teacher Krista McAuliffe on the Space Shuttle Challenger launch into space.
Roger, Challenger. Obviously a major malfunction.
We could not believe what we were seeing. The Challenger Legacy. To hear more, search for science fiction and look out for The Challenger Legacy. Find it wherever you get your podcasts or on the ABC Listen app.
It's the world's greatest humanitarian crisis that's displaced more than 10 million people and pushed millions more into severe hunger.
Sudan isn't always in the headlines, but it should be. It's in a rapid downward spiral, so why aren't we talking more about the enduring and disastrous war that threatens the whole region with instability?
And where are the urgent efforts for a ceasefire?
I'm Kylie Morris.
I'm Latika Burke. And on this episode, Global Roaming returns to Sudan.
The International Criminal Court says atrocities committed in the Sudanese city of El Fasher could amount to crimes against humanity and war crimes. The city of El Fasher fell to the paramilitary rapid support forces last week, and what has followed is being described as a massacre.
After capturing the city from the Sudanese army following an 18-month siege, while the army's retreat is a potential turning point in Sudan's brutal civil war, as El Fasher was their last remaining foothold in the west of the country. Now, this means that the RSF is effectively in control of the Darfur region, and there are growing claims of atrocities in El Fasher.
And the story of this war goes beyond Sudan's borders. The UN says external support is enabling the conflict. It didn't name specific countries, but one keeps coming up.
So, Latika, I do think we misunderstand a lot about the war in Sudan that's going on at the moment. It is very complex, certainly, and it is devastating in terms of its impacts on the civilian population. But I think a lot of what we think is going on there is shaped by memories of the Darfur crisis of 20 years ago. I mean, we all remember that, don't we? You know, George Clooney, other Hollywood stars, you know, set out to raise the profile of the genocide there and push for those responsible to be held to account.
Right now we're standing here on the border of Chad and Darfur. A lot of bad things are happening over here right now. My father and I thought we'd come over and take a look for ourselves.
We started in South Sudan. It took 2 days to get to the border of Darfur. We heard there were a lot of refugees pouring south. We found a village called Jacques with over 1,000 displaced families. This isn't a refugee camp. There are no tents to shelter them. Most just sleep under trees. No food, no water. These people had jobs and property before the Arab Janjaweed militia burned their villages, raped their women, and killed their children.
Yes, I mean, that was a very vivid memory, but it's striking that those searing images aren't around today. We just have completely tuned out of this war in Sudan. I think it's not even to your point, Kylie, that a lot of people misunderstand. I think a lot of people just don't know that it's even going on at the scale it is.
It's interesting, you know, wherever you live in Australia, there were, I think at the time, so at that time in the 2000s, 20,000 Sudanese refugees arrived here, bringing, you know, their story of survival to our towns and cities. But now they, I guess, along with the rest of us, can only watch as this next cycle of catastrophe descends. Should we just do a kind of quick summary of what the situation there is now? We'll get more from our guests shortly, but let's start off with who's fighting. There are two main groups, aren't there?
Yes, so there's the paramilitary, RSF, which is short for the Rapid Support Forces. Now, they form the remnants of the Janjaweed, the Arab militia, which was accused of the genocide in the 2000s. And their opponents is the Sudanese army.
Mm. And I think we need to find out from our guest, you know, what is it that both these sides are fighting for? But what's also critical to understand is that this isn't just about these two rivals. There are outside powers well and truly at work playing an outsized role, aren't they? So who's backing who, Latika?
Yes, a bit of a proxy war taking place. Egypt is backing the army. The UAE heavily supports the RSF. But we've got some other players wielding influence here. Qatar, Turkey, Iran and Saudi Arabia.
And I guess while all of that sounds really messy, that should, you'd imagine, also open up some space for peace talks, right? Because we have lots of different actors, all with leverage over what's going on inside Sudan. And you would perhaps imagine from that then that a ceasefire should be within reach. However, I fear we're about to learn from our guest that that is not actually the case. Let's have a chat to him. His name is Matt Nashid, and he's a political analyst, but also a freelance journalist. He's worked for Al Jazeera. He's covered the Middle East and Africa for many years, but has been really closely focused on what's going on in Sudan since 2018. And here he is. So Matt Nashid, welcome to Global Roaming.
Thanks for having me.
Can you zero in on the damage this conflict is having on the civilian population? I know you've written about Al-Fashir. Tell me the story of what happened there.
When the army's final defenses collapsed in late October, RSF fighters stormed in and aligned, you know, Arab militias and killed most likely tens of thousands of people, perhaps even more. And they, just like any authoritarian regime or authoritarian actor, they're also trying to completely hide their crimes. So there's been no access to see what exactly the full damage is. But satellite imagery from the Yale Humanitarian Research Center, which uses satellite imagery to provide a sense of atrocities taking place and violations, has said that there's at least 60,000 people that we just don't know what happened to them. And it fears the worst that presumably that they may have all been killed. We know that abductions on a scale in the tens of thousands have taken place. We know that when people were fleeing, the RSF even took people and according to witness testimonies, attempted to draw blood from them for their own blood banks. So literally acting as vampires in a way. Rape has been used to subject women and girls that are coming out. We know that they've abducted children and used them as, you know, essentially a form of labor and cattle herders. And they've also used children as fighters in this conflict forcefully as well, that has been reported. So there's just a litany of abuses and grave atrocities that have taken place.
I now give the floor to Deputy Prosecutor Nazat Shamim Khan.
Mr. President, thank you for the opportunity to brief the Security Council today. Since I last addressed this council, the situation in Darfur has darkened even further. Darfuris, as we speak, are being subjected to collective torture. The fall of Al-Fashir to the RSF has been accompanied by an organized, calculated campaign of the most profound suffering, targeting non-Arab communities in particular.
But the frightening thing about it is actually what's not known, what's not definitive. Until this day, there's countless thousands of people. We don't know the fate of them.
Based on information and evidence collected by the office, it is the assessment of the Office of the Prosecutor that war crimes and crimes against humanity have been committed in Al-Fashir. Rape, arbitrary detention, executions, mass graves, all perpetrated on a massive scale. Many of these crimes have been filmed and celebrated by those committing them. This dreadful situation is still ongoing, fueled by a sense of complete impunity. Our response to this must not be mere platitudes here in this chamber, but must represent real action on the ground.
Many others are presumed dead, and many others are presumed abducted. And there was at least 60,000 that again, we just don't know what happened to them. And I think that's the most terrifying thing, not what we do know, but what we don't.
What are you focused on right now? What's the story that needs to be told by your judgment?
I think the overwhelming narrative is, you know, how do we characterize this conflict and this war? This is fundamentally a counter-revolutionary war that ignited after a coup d'etat took place in 2021 that reversed all of the gains that a popular uprising that had brought down the previous autocratic regime in 2019 had made. And then the actors, or the two fundamental forces that did that coup d'etat, then turned their guns on one another. And that's not to say that there's an equivalence in the abuses that they've committed, but certainly that is the root in which this started, as, you know, as a power struggle between the same two forces that sabotaged the popular democratic aspirations of a nation and of an entire generation, I would say. And so I think that should always be kept in mind when we're seeing the largest, you know, humanitarian disaster by most measures in the world right now.
How on earth is this not being held to account? How are they getting away with it?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, that's been the history, I think, of Sudan and the broader region for so long. Everyone's able to get away with everything. Until now, since the first war in Darfur back in 2003, that led to indictments against the former government. Even the military right now has essentially played a role in not handing over those suspects to the ICC. So the military doesn't want to hand over previous suspects from the old regime from the ICC, while calling for the ICC to investigate the RSF, which is its former ally and now a foe in this war, in the Darfur. And yeah, that's noble, of course. We would like to see that some semblance of accountability, but we also see how accountability in international avenues and institutions are politicized, and that they're wielded, you know, by stronger actors and weaker actors, weaker governments, for political purposes. Another example of this is shortly after what happened in El Fasher, there was a UN fact-finding mission that requested access, that the army didn't even grant that access in the name of sovereignty. Why didn't they grant that access? Because even when they're at war with one another, there's still, a shared logic that enables both of their atrocities, which is maintaining a total climate of impunity. And the army is very, very afraid that if there's a precedent stated by the UN fact-finding mission getting access to El Fasher, for instance, then eventually the UN fact-finding mission might request access to another area where both parties have committed atrocities, you know, perhaps such as in Gezira State in central Sudan, where both parties have committed mass killings. The RSF, while it was ruling it, and then when it was taken back by the army also committed mass killings on an ethnic basis and on a community basis, killing hundreds, perhaps, you know, some in the thousands of people. We're fully unsure. So accountability is a shared logic that reinforces the impunity of both of them.
Who then has the upper hand? And are these two parties just going to keep slugging it out?
Yeah, it looks that way. And at the expense of everybody else. So, you know, I think while both sides are committing abuses, conventionally, the RSF, by all metrics, have committed significantly more. And this is the lived experience of Sudanese on the ground. However, at the same time, I think, at least from my interactions with people, vast majority of people, maybe not the ones that are most vocal online, just want this to end. They want this to end. You know, they want to be able to go back to their homes. They want to be able to try to find out where their loved ones are that are separated from them. Life is incredibly difficult in exile. They want to rebuild. Now, yeah, what does an end look like? Of course, peace agreements, you know, prior peace agreements in Sudan, and I think globally, criticisms of peacemaking is that it could sow the seeds for future conflict if not done properly. But the situation in Sudan is just so extremely dire. When you ask people, they're like, we just want this to end in any way. And what we're having essentially is one side that is feigning any interest in that, any interest in the ceasefire, and claiming that, you know, they are interested in, of course, but then committing mass atrocities on the ground, which is the RSF. And the other that is, you know, essentially intent on continuing this war in large aspects, because I believe at least that if the war ends, then there would be also a reckoning for the army as well, as people, you know, turn their ear towards it and focus back on civilian politics and rebuilding at some point. Then they realize that their support in large cases is predicated in some degree on the continuation of this war against a group that is committing such mass atrocities. So again, even in conflict, they somehow enable one another at the expense of everybody else, though the violations are not equal. And the reality on the ground is that this can go on for many, many years. Wars in Sudan in the past have gone on for decades, at least two decades. And it's terrifying because the longer this goes, the more extreme abuses that will take place. And they also have the international backers in order to allow them to carry this on for you know, the foreseeable future and then some.
Matt, let's talk about who's backing who and who's effectively bankrolling the war for their own advantage. I mean, you talk about, you know, how both sides don't seem to be necessarily making any ground or necessarily have enough power to win victory over the other. But presumably their backers are making something out of this, right? They're invested in this war continuing. Who's benefiting from it?
Everyone. I would say the primary benefactor of all this, not to say that not everybody else is benefiting, but the primary one, in my view, and the outsized actors, the United Arab Emirates. I might even go so far to argue.
And who are they backing?
They're backing the RSF, but they're also financing the army as well. And so that relationship became deeper and deeper, and then was also predicated a lot on the exportation of gold, because the Emirates has the most developed refinery, you know, relative to everybody else in the region. And then at the same time, it also understood that by instrumentalizing the RSF, what it could do is essentially colonize large aspects of the Sudanese state and use that for effectively importing significant amounts of gold. We could look into livestock. We could look into a number of other resources as well, covered in port access. But at the same time, this last thing I'll say, the army is also needs gold to finance essentially its operations, right? And it has a large mine, the Kush mine, which the New York Times reported some time ago was initially under Russian ownership, but then the army didn't realize that the conglomerate was essentially bought up by the Emirates, and those proceeds continue to head to the United Arab Emirates. And then the army takes those proceeds in order to purchase weapons to continue to fight its war. So effectively, while politically, diplomatically, and in terms of overt weapon supplies, the Emirates are backing the RSF. It is also very much financing, you know, to a significant extent, though not the same, the war effort of the army at the same time.
Matt, wars are endable. If the war in Sudan were to come to an end, who would be in the position of brokering it, in your view?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, right now the framework has been the Quad, which is essentially the countries that are primarily fueling it, and critics would say that you're asking the arsonists to put out the fire. The people that are fueling it now need to be in position to broker peace. And so, you know, when we look into the real aspects of things, real politics of things, it's really difficult to imagine, especially as we're at this point in time, the imperfect and faulty international system that we had at least tried to attempt in some scenarios to play a mediating role and to broker an end to conflict to some degree, although its track record was admittedly quite poor. But we're seeing the total demise of that. And as a result of that, I think we're going to see a significant increase in middle power imperialism, which, just replicated, I think, the greater power imperialism that compromised the previous international system. It's hard for me to find within this current environment, within the U.S., you know, when they're trying to pull all their money out of international institutions and Europe as well, which isn't stepping up to the bill, that suddenly there's going to be a grown-up at the table that sees just the broader regional implications for this for everybody, and also is driven by some semblance of a conscience for what they're seeing on the ground. It's hard for me to see that. So then the answer just falls back on it. It's most likely from real political situation going to have to be the arsonists that are fueling this. And I think this is also going to set domestic, you know, political aspirations significantly back. But this is where the current international climate is trending, and this is so somewhat what we're seeing.
And Matt, just finally, can you tell me why you got so interested in Sudan? What's it like for you covering this ongoing, I guess, spiral into worse and worse humanitarian and military catastrophe?
Yeah, I mean, to answer the first question, I became a journalist. You know, my generation was mostly at the start of the Arab Spring. You know, for regardless of the criticisms and the results of what took place across the region, it was a moment of euphoria where civilians and global mobilization or regional mobilization really inspired mobilization of a neighboring country and so on. And we saw this domino effect because there was a moment where people believed collectively they can drive change even if they're completely against the odds, against incredibly repressive regimes that are internationally supported and regionally supported. Fast forward to 2019, we saw another wave of popular uprisings that started to rock East Africa and North Africa and the broader Middle East as well, in Iraq, Algeria, and Sudan. And being you know, from the Nile myself, or being Egyptian, I was very quite interested at the time what was happening just next door and in Sudan, and getting to know more about just the grassroots mobilization and the civilian initiatives and how strong community ties were and how that all could be tapped into to drive faith in political change and for real, a genuine, you know, democratic system that doesn't look something like it's imposed, but something very much as a reflection of the society itself and the generational efforts of youth there was very much inspiring. And the continuing interest in it in a lot of ways is because I still believe that despite all of this militarization and despite the extreme humanitarian catastrophe, I think it's worth noting that the only thing that has not been liquidated entirely from that time, in my view, are the civilian networks that coordinated democratic protests and that would coordinate at the time the rescuing of people, for instance, when they were hit by, you know, rubber bullets, real bullets, or tear gas, and you know, the community initiatives. All of these have now been transformed in war as essentially local humanitarian units. And they're the only ones that are keeping people quite literally alive by opening up daycares for children amid the war, by ferrying escape routes when the RSF storms a village, by, you know, running hospitals and powering hospitals and taking care of the elderly. The same networks that were driving the pro-democracy movement are now driving the humanitarian response right now, which means that, you know, even in light of the most extreme violence that we can see, it's really difficult to liquidate those structures that were built and established during a time of revolutionary fervor. And I find that still quite inspiring. And I find it of no coincidence that both sides in this war have attempted to target these humanitarians and activists, across the areas in which they're operating in their respective zones. And again, they both have, this goes back to why they waged a coup to begin with, that while they both see themselves as an existential threat, the threat that they arguably see larger than both of each other is the potential for another civil uprising and civil aspirations that would mean, civilian politics prevails over this type of militarization.
Matt, thanks so much for your time and for that comprehensive look at what is going on in Sudan. At times, I think you were competing with the noise from the school next door there in Beirut, but we heard you loud and clear, and really appreciate your time.
Thanks. Thanks again, guys, for having me on.
Kylie, I've got to say, I thought that was going to be a very hard-going interview, and it was, but I was actually very empowered by some of the things he was saying there about the civilian almost resistance that has not left the war-weary people of Sudan.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's difficult to see a sign of hope from this distance, given the other detail that Matt was telling us about the, you know, level of abuses and violence and who's bankrolling the war and why the war is continuing. But I, like you, was a bit relieved that he at least finds civil society architecture. There are people supporting one another and imagining that there will be a time when this conflict isn't raging around them. I mean, I'm curious about the way that external actors are kind of manipulating this and the political economy of the war, the fact that these sides don't seem to be able to eclipse one another, and yet the fighting just carries on and on. So this question of, you know, asking the arsonists to put out the war, you know, when you've got the UAE and Egypt both involved in propagating the war and supplying weapons and supporting either side, but then they're also being involved in a way, they're also involved in the mediation to try to bring the war to a close, and they're, you know, supplying one another with different investments and benefits that mean that even though they have proxies fighting against one another in Sudan, they're kind of cooperating on a business and investment level at the same time.
Protection racket was the phrase that kept springing to mind as Matt was speaking, particularly that anecdote he gave about, or this observation about how the two sides actually, it was in their own interests to keep protecting each other, because what if one of them is in the dock? That could lead to the other eventually being in the dock too. I mean, I thought that was just so bleak.
Mm. And that plea of his for this, you know, the nostalgia we now have for this flawed international system where there were institutions and where the ICJ and the ICC, you know, might have been able to hold, you know, even the international backers for these kind of militias and armies accountable. And even though we know fully how imperfect that system is, we can see what the complete absence of any kind of holding to account does. I mean, that's what's playing out in Sudan.
Yes, I thought it was striking when he talked about the middle powers in that way, because for a lot of our discussion on global roaming this year, we've been talking about middle powers having new agency to do better things or to form more positively aligned coalitions amongst each other. But suddenly you're hearing Matt talk about middle powers in a predatory way, aping some of the worst behaviour of the bigger powers. That to me was quite startling.
Mm. Yeah, it's difficult stuff, but absolutely worth us doing, I think, and persevering with. I mean, I think we are going to keep talking about Sudan here on Global Roaming, and we are determined to spend more time now that we have more episodes in Africa. I mean, that's your time zone, Latika.
Yeah, I mean, we've already done two in, what, a few weeks. So I think our yes. I think our interest rate is going pretty well, Kylie, if I do say so myself.
If you do have ideas of what you'd like us to focus on or questions you'd like answered by Geraldine and Hamish on the Your Call episode, please get in touch. We welcome it, all kinds of feedback, global.roaming@abc.net.au. We'll be back with a fresh episode tomorrow at 11 a.m. or in your podcast feed. Thanks for your company. We'll talk next week.
See you next week, Kylie.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.